Do I have to wait till the bell rings, or what? Okay, so welcome to the first session of the afternoon, and our first speaker is Søren Brunet from the Technical University of Denmark, and also the University of Copenhagen. Joint appointments, unusual in most countries, and so he'll speak on the transcript.
Thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation. So sorry about the missing title. I'm normally not that persistent in ignoring emails, but something must have happened here. So the main topic here will be how to understand biological mechanisms, disease mechanisms, via interactomes, primarily protein interaction data combined with other types of data. So it's nice to be back at the Newton Institute, where I actually, together with Pierre Baldi more than 10 years ago, worked on our book on bioinformatics and machine learning. And at that time, there were not that many buildings here, but I've been here a couple of times since, but it's been some years ago. So thanks again for the invitation. So we want to especially hook into interaction data, because these data often give you a sort of clear picture of what is going on, and they also very often suggest an experiment when you postulate that some protein interacts with another protein and it is important in relation to a disease or a biological mechanism. It's easy to do the follow-up experiment. So it's an interesting data type to work on as a basis, and then add on other types of data, as you will see in the talk. So we have started sort of going beyond what you would call conventional bioinformatics and systems biology, as we now hook more and more into medical informatics data at hospitals. We've started to look at electronic patient records, biobank questionnaire, and text data that describes sort of clinical phenotypes, and I'll talk a little bit about that. These areas, often they are viewed as relatively young, but actually if you go back, people have worked within these areas for more than 30, 40 years. And what is important, I think, especially with the medical informatics area, is that the amounts of data in electronic form is also expanding exponentially at the moment. We're used to looking at the sequence data and the other types of molecular level data in bioinformatics and their exponential growth. But the same is the case, for example, in the healthcare sector, where all hospital systems are now being made electronic, and the amount of computer accessible data is growing very much. So we try to combine these data and extract information from text that can be used to, for example, prioritize disease genes and integrate the data in that way. Very often we also have to work with problems that include a changing environment. This is also something that interests us. A lot of systems biology is in some sense static. You would like to understand how this particular cell type works. But of course, its properties change over time if for example, the chemical environment changes. I will not talk about this today, but in Copenhagen we have, for example, a big problem, a big project on infertility. Because this is a huge problem in Europe, but it's the worst in Denmark. The semen quality in Denmark is the worst in Europe. There's no risk in being together with Danish men anymore. much worse in Finland, much higher risk, and so on. And this is, of course, not because the genes changed over this 50-year period where the infertility has changed. So we work on also establishing large chemical data warehouses and see how they can be mapped to pathways. But I think it's very important because a lot of the information on how the environment changed, the environment for the genome, is actually deposited in these electronic patient records and of course also in a lot of patient records on paper and so on. And if we want to hook into that information, we need to sort of deal with a new data domain. And this is essentially what is written here. These are sort of non-traditional data types. And one of the topics I will talk about today is how we sort of started up hooking into the text that describes clinical phenotypes. But I think in bioinformatics, we are reasonably used to messy, noisy databases at the molecular level, but this is nothing compared to what we see in hospital healthcare systems. I mean, if you want examples of databases with missing data, with noise and so on, you should just go to any hospital. It's much worse than we even thought of. Okay, so the protein interaction data is something that many groups have used in modeling, and this type of data is not growing exponentially at the moment. It's sort of more in a linear phase. Here you see over time for different databases and the number of interactions in the databases how it seems to grow. It can be a little bit tricky to make this kind of statistics, but it's clear that PPI data is sort of in the linear phase, and presumably now where proteomics is really ramping up in different countries, that we will soon see a transition into exponential growth for this kind of data. It's very important to work actually with more or less all the databases around. There's no single database that you can use and extract all the useful interactions from. Here, for example, we have made a human interaction network between all human proteins, and we have tried to transfer many of the interactions from other organisms through alignment via identification of orthologous proteins. And here you see this is sort of a scale on the number of interactions that come from various databases and how many you can find in one database or the other. This is not the same color. So there's a lot of complementarity in the different databases, and you can actually also go and cluster them and see how they relate to one another. So this is unfortunately a data type where you need to work with many different databases, and you need to cope with the different formats that do not always correspond. So we want to use this type of data to find, for example, new disease genes, new disease proteins, and also prioritize them using data integration techniques. And it's clear that most proteins are doing their job together with other proteins. They form protein complexes, and it's also clear that many disease phenotypes arise not only from mutations in one particular protein, but also in mutations in other proteins that participates in the same complex. So you can get the same phenotype from mutations in different members of such a protein complex. And this is what we, in particular, exploit when we use known disease genes or known disease proteins to pick up and discover new examples that relate to a particular disease, and then prioritize them using Bayesian methods. So in this prioritization, we use clinical descriptions of diseases, and of course not all diseases are devastating, like breast cancer and so on. Here we have one of the more funny diseases, namely the Achieu syndrome. And this is an inheritable disease, and you can read here how it runs in a family. And so here you actually start sneezing when you are exposed to light. Many of you know presumably about this disease. But it's clear that it is difficult from this clinical description to discover the genes that actually relate or underlies this disease. But this is, of course, the same basic problem as if we work with a more devastating disease like schizophrenia or breast cancer and so on. But this is a data type that we now use, and I will tell you about the approach. Basically, you can take these clinical descriptions and you can use various programs to map these natural language texts to controlled vocabularies, for example, the unified medical language system. And in this way, get sort of a word representation of a particular disease or disease subtype. There's a lot of details in that I will not go into. But many different groups and also companies use this kind of approach where you try to identify words that relates to a particular phenotype. Here we have the words that we extracted from breast cancer from the OMIM records. And you can, of course, do that for thousands of different diseases. And you will see how a word like metastasis, for example, will not be found when you go to schizophrenia and so on. So this is a sort of standardized way of then comparing the diseases. And you can, of course, use reasonably primitive approaches for then quantifying the similarity between different diseases, because typically when you have a linkage interval, for example, with 500 different genes, and you know that there are one or more genes in that interval that presumably links to the disease, you would of course like to prioritize them according to the phenotype that you are interested in. So our approach was designed in this way, was published last year, where we essentially take, in this case, text from the OMIM database, and then we use these programs to map the text to UMLS. And then there's a lot of weighting and a lot of details on that. But out of this, you will get word vectors that will describe a specific disease. And then you can, for example, just measure the angle between them if you would like to quantify the similarity between, for example, schizophrenia and breast cancer. And of course, in that particular case, there might not be a lot of overlapping pathways. But this is, of course, the case for many diseases where you have partial overlap in the phenotypes. That is caused by partial overlap in the pathways behind the disease. If you return, for example, to the Achu syndrome, you would not think that many other diseases would look like that disease. But when you run over all the disease with your ankle measurement, we find something called gastric sneezing that is a similar reflex, but now not from light. But when the stomach is full, you start sneezing, and in this case here, I think for the Achu syndrome, you could sneeze as many as 43 times per year. It's more limited. But actually, you can, using this kind of approach, you can quantify the similarity between any two diseases, and gastric sneezing and the Achu syndrome is quite close to one another. And in this way, you can compute the sort of phenotypical overlap over all diseases. And you can, of course, also make up your own text describing a new disease if it is not in the database and see how it relates phenotypically via the words to a lot of other diseases. And this kind of matrix you can use to prioritize disease genes. In many cases, you have, in relation to one disease, a list of genes where you would like to identify the most probable. And these, as I said, might come from linkage intervals where you have 500 genes and you would like to prioritize them and add probabilities to all these genes according to how likely it is that each of them are sort of the incriminated one by the data. But this could also be a list that you would have identified from, for example, transcriptomics data, you find a set of upregulated or downregulated genes, and you would then like to subsequently prioritize them. And the way we do that is to take each of them, then we go to the protein interaction databases, and we use this orthology inferred human interaction network. So we pick up interaction partners for each of these candidate genes, and then we use the text mining to quantify how likely is it that this particular gene encodes a protein that relates to the disease. So the disease we're looking at here is colored red. So we can have a scale here in color that sort of colors the interactions partners according to how large the phenotypical overlap between the diseases that these proteins have been related to, how large it is compared to the red disease that we are looking at. And if we have 500 genes in the interval, we can then prioritize or get scores for each of them. And behind this is a sort of a Bayesian approach where we use a huge benchmark set to estimate a lot of different parameters. But you can see in this case here, among all these candidates, the candidate number 3 was the most red because it interacts with proteins that have been related to diseases that word-wise in their clinical descriptions are similar. So there's a Bayesian approach behind all that I will not go into. We estimate all the parameters. What is important is that you should try to benchmark such a system, and this is what we did using 1700 linkage intervals where we knew the disease gene. And we have different score cutoffs, as you can see here. And then you see the precision on the y-axis. And if you, for example, use a cutoff of 0.2, we will have a precision of 50%. So in the cases where we make predictions, half of them will be correct. In half the cases, we will, in these linkage intervals, be able to give the highest priority to the correct gene using the interaction data in the databases. And of course, you can claim that it is easier to discover a known disease gene for which there is a lot of interaction experiments in the literature, and hence a lot of interaction data in the databases. So the lower curve here is a model that is estimated using high throughput interaction data only. So if you take a lot of interaction screens from Drosophila, from C. elegans, from yeast, and so on, of course these interaction screens have no bias whatsoever towards any disease because you just try to pick up interactions between proteins in that particular organism in the interactome of that organism. And you see here that the quality of the recall goes down, but it now drops to 1 out of 3. So it is actually sort of showing that even with unbiased interactome data and this prioritization using the text mining of the clinical phenotype data, you can make a prioritization that is reasonably good, and often you're just having a list of upregulated genes and you don't know how to go on from that and prioritize them further. This can of course be used to identify new disease genes for given organisms for given diseases. Here we have identified some new cancer, including breast cancer related genes. So in cancer genome sequencing, it's important to identify new genes that relate to cancer. And we have used our approach here to identify genes that never before have been related to this particular cancer. And then you can give them to the cancer sequencing people, and you see the scores out here and where they are on the chromosomes and so on. So you can essentially take the entire genome, and then you can prioritize all the genes according to one specific phenotype. And then, of course, you can get rid of all the known ones, and then the first one that has never before been related to that disease, you can hand over to a cancer genome sequencing project. And this we do together with Beijing Genomics Institute. Here's another example from type 1 diabetes, where when you do this kind of approach in linkage intervals, of course you pick up a lot of the known players in type 1 diabetes, but we also found a new gene. And as I said before, when you have these interactions postulated, so this is ranked high because again the protein here interacts with a few proteins that have sort of close similarity with the type 1 diabetes phenotype. So it pops up, and then of course you can immediately go and make follow-up experiments, and this is what our collaborators did. They showed, for example, that the more you add of this gene, the more you activate NF-kappa beta, and you get sort of a pro-apoptotic effect out of that you then can sort of use in further studies. You can also use this kind of approach to continue from where normal conventional cohort-associated studies often end. Often you demonstrate that you have epistasis between different regions on the chromosome. You can show that different regions on the chromosome interact. And of course, this is not always because the different regions encode proteins that together form a protein complex. It can also be, of course, because the promoter of one gene forms sort of genetic interaction with the protein from another region and so on. But you can try to see whether you can explain such genetic interactions between different regions by protein interaction data. And this is indeed what we did in this paper that just came out in Genome Biology for type 1 diabetes, where we have different regions that have been shown to interact genetically. We can then, and the genetic interactions are the curly ones you see here, we can then pick up proteins from these regions and show that they interact with each other and forms a complex. So this is an interesting extension of this kind of work, where you use the phenotype association, but also the interaction data. Of course, you can add many other types of data, but this is sort of the simplest way of putting it. As I said, we have just started, and I think people all over the world are trying now to exploit new data types for defining new diseases and see how known diseases actually subcategorize, so that you maybe also can use that subcategorization as a guideline when you would like to make individual treatment and so on. And we have started to look at Danish electronic patient records. I think the situation, as I said, at the hospitals are much worse than I had hoped for. But there's one good thing about the Nordic countries in general. For example, in Denmark, we have registries and databases where we can follow everybody who have been hospitalized since the beginning of the 60s, because the social security number in Denmark came in 1962. So you can backtrack a lot of this stuff if you can get information out of the patient records. So we have not really done any text mining yet shown in this graph, but you can, for example, take the disease classification codes, the International Classification of Diseases system in its 10th version here, and in many records these terms are put in also because the hospital are paid according to the terms that are in the records, and that is often the only incentive for the doctor to put them in. They describe the patient and so on very well, but the classification is often very incomplete. This set of records here, actually, we had 6,000 records from the largest Danish mental hospitals, and only in 3,000 of them we had ICD-10 terms. So one task here is actually to take the electronic patient record and then predict the disease classification from the text. But you see here that if you just take the records where you have the disease classification codes, and of course when you are at a mental hospital, you're not only having mental illnesses, you're also having other diseases. So the ICD-10 system is divided into chapters, and chapter 5 is the one with mental and behavioral disorders. But you have a lot of other. You can have cancer, I mean, you can have diabetes and so on, so you can have many other ICD-10 codes that belongs to other chapters, and you can see here how all the patients cluster. And this is, of course, very primitive, but I think eventually, when we will be able to take 10 years of electronic patient records, we will be able to see new correlations between diseases, and we will be able to identify and define new diseases from these texts. And of course also use it, as I said, as the basis for individualized treatment, that some of these clusterings of just of the ICD-10 code vectors here will identify patient groups. So I'm sure that this type of data will be used in the future heavily to prioritize the molecular data that we are used to working on. So this was one example, general in relation to diseases, where we integrated two data types, clinical descriptions and interaction data, and got a fairly simple, I would say, primitive text-based prioritization scheme made. Of course, with a lot of Bayesian mechanics behind that is used to estimate the parameters in the model. I will tell you about another interactome project that also I think is interesting at this conference, because it relates to evolution. It, of course, also relates to diseases, because the cell cycle is, of course, very important in relation to cancer. But we did, in collaboration with Per Borg and Lars Juel Jensen at the EMBL, over some years, work on data integration around the cell cycle. And for the cell cycle, we, of course, not only have interaction data that is interesting, but in particular, transcriptomics data. You would like to know which genes are involved in driving the cell cycle. Of course, in different organisms, you would like to know that they might not be the same genes, but as you know, Nobel Prizes have been given for the fact that the core cell cycle machinery is strongly conserved. Many of the proteins that are involved, they have the same structure in different organisms and so on. So there's a high degree of conservation of the core cell cycle machinery in different organisms. And one way to identify cell cycle regulated genes is, of course, to synchronize cell cultures and then make experiments at different time points, and then you can follow certain genes that are peaking then in different of the cell cycle phases, for example the S phase and so on. So the transcriptomics data is a very important data type when you would like to model the cell cycle. And from these temporal patterns of gene expression over time, here we have two cell cycles, we can see that certain categories of genes, for example, the DNA replication-related genes, they peak in the S phase and so on, where the DNA is replicated. And you can see the pre-replication gene category is peaking a little bit before. So the Fourier analysis of these data are, of course, important in identifying from any given genome, for example, the yeast genome, which of the 6,200 yeast genes are periodic. And this is one data type where people really have tried to design many different algorithms for identification of the periodic genes from transcriptomics data. And we made a paper a few years ago published in Bioinformatics where we compared all these different algorithms. We of course also suggested our own. But here, what you see here for yeast is that we have the number of genes that we deem periodic on the x-axis here, and then we have a quality indicator out here. We have some benchmark sets that we use to benchmark the different methods. How many of these benchmark genes that all agree should be periodically expressed in a given organism can we identify? And the line here corresponds to random. And you can see that many, especially of the newer methods here, it's hard to follow the colors here, are actually quite bad. While our new method here, from a very recent paper in nucleic acid research, but also one of the older ones, one of the first ones, the one from the Spellman paper in 1998 is actually quite good. So when people say that new genes are cell cycle regulated and so on, you really have to look at the algorithm they used to identify the periodicity and the regulation in the cell cycle. In the cyclebase.org paper, we describe these different organisms and these different algorithms, and our algorithm is based on a combination of periodicity and the magnitude of regulation. I don't want to go into details, but there was a particular very confusing paper last year from Liu et al. That came up with completely new lists of, not completely, but strongly deviating lists of periodic genes in different organisms. And you see, according to our benchmark here, the blue cross is really suboptimal. So while you, for example, in the plant Arabidopsis thaliana here, will only identify a very small subset of from the benchmark, you with the same level of genes, for example, 400 and something genes, you will include many more true positives. So it's crucial when you would like to identify what is periodic, but in particular when you would like to compare across different organisms, that you use the same algorithm for analyzing all the data sets. And the take-home message is that most of the newer methods are actually worse than some of the simpler methods. There are also people who have just looked at the data and say, is this periodic or not? And it's actually not too bad. You can make very complicated algorithms that are much worse than that. So when you would like to look at this at the protein complex level, you can of course go with your list, for example in yeast, and say now we have 600 genes that are periodic, roughly 10% of the genome, that varies with the cell cycle. And then we can go to the interaction databases. So here we have color-coded according to when the gene peaks. So it's not all the genes in these lists that we can peak assign, but a large fraction of them we can assign a peak time to, and then we can color the protein or the gene according to when it peaks, whether it peaks in the G1 phase or S phase. And then we can actually go and look for interactions in the interaction databases, and these are the connecting lines you see here. And it looks like you have a lot of genes that interact, where the proteins they encode interact when they peak far apart in the cell cycle. But actually this is because you cannot see all the small lines. If you make a histogram of the distance in the cell cycle and the number of interactions, actually most of the interactions we pick up here from the databases are between proteins that peak, where the genes peak in expression close in time. So this is comforting because this is of course completely independent data. These interaction data have been made in hundreds of labs. And of course out of this you can make protein complexes, you can cluster the interaction data, and you can also add in interactions to white proteins. So these are proteins that are expressed more or less constantly at during the cell cycle. So you get sort of molecular machines out of this. You get combinations of constantly expressed proteins and colored proteins out of that. And if you look more closely at it, then the surprise when we did this was that essentially all the protein complexes that we identify in this way are combinations of colored and white proteins. So the cell cycle is not run by molecular machines that are made just in time, because then all the proteins, all the machines here would be colored. We have a lot of proteins that seem to be encoded by genes, which are more or less constantly expressed. So what seems to happen is that the protein complexes are not made just when they are needed during the cell cycle, but they are activated just when they are needed during the cell cycle. So some of the components are made all the time, but then extra components are made such that they can activate the protein complex at the right time during the cell cycle. So this is sort of just in time assembly or activation principle, and not just in time synthesis principle for the complexes that runs the cell cycle. And of course, it's interesting to, this was yeast, so you can compare to other organisms, and we are sort of limited by the amount of transcriptomics data we have. I mean, for this work here, we combined, again, just two data types, protein interaction data and transcriptomics data, and got this temporal picture of the interaction patterns and the complexes. So one can say that we used the temporal data from the transcriptomics experiments to add time to a very static data type, namely the interaction data. They are typically just static in the sense that you just know that protein A and B interacts or participates in a complex. So they might not interact directly, but also indirectly via other partners. But we are limited by the amount of transcriptomics data available, and there are more organisms coming up now, but of course it is difficult to synchronize these cell cultures and make the experiments. But here are four organisms that when we did the work 2 years ago, for which transcriptomics experiments had been performed with synchronized cells, and here are some of the data sets. I just skip over that. So the first surprise was that the transcriptional regulation is very, very poorly conserved. As I said before, Nobel Prizes have been given for the fact that the core cell cycle machinery is conserved. So it's sort of roughly the same protein that participates in many of the processes. But when you go to regulation, if you have one gene that, for example, is periodic in man, then you would expect that the same gene would also be regulated in the same way in yeast, because, for example, the protein and its function and also the protein complex and so on is highly conserved. But actually, when we took the different proteins, we took 600 from Saccharomyces cerevisiae, 600 from Pompe, and 500 from man, and 400 from Arabidopsis, and we identified orthologous groups, and we had roughly 400 orthologous groups. Only in 5 cases could we see that the gene was regulated in the same way in the different organisms. So this was a big surprise that the transcriptional regulation of the core cell cycle genes is so poorly conserved. And of course, we are missing stuff here. We have noise. We might have 100 more periodic genes in yeast and so on. But this will most likely just bring this number up to maybe 21 or 40 or something like that. It's still presumably be correct that if a gene is periodically regulated during the cell cycle in one organism, it is most not likely not periodic in all the other organisms. So of course you have more similarity when you keep, you look at the two yeasts and so on. And of course also we should remember, we heard in the previous talk, how things differ in different tissues and different cell types and so on. We will presumably also see differences between the cell cycle in the different cell types in man, for example, when we get that kind of data. But again, it indicates that the regulation of these genes actually can change a lot. And we think that the explanation is the one that we saw in yeast, that actually when you have, so here we have three different organisms, the plant is out, and three different molecular machines here. You can see that now the constantly expressed proteins are gray and not white, but you can see how the periodicity and the transcriptional regulation moves around. If we have one machine here, these three components are periodic in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and then it is only one in Schizosaccharomyces pompe that is regulated. So the transcription regulation moves around, but it presumably doesn't matter. When you have a molecular machine with four components, it doesn't matter which of the four components you regulate, as long as the machine will get active at the correct point in time. So this color change you see in Pompe is actually well known, that the faces in the different organisms are not the same length. So there's nothing surprising in this. But we suggest that this is the basic explanation why the transcription regulation of these very important genes controlling cell division can be so badly conserved. As you also know, many of the cell cycle related proteins are heavily phosphorylated. They are modified in various ways. And what you see here is two statistical tests for comparison of the colored dynamic proteins with the gray static proteins here. And if we just take for various organisms all the dynamic proteins and compare them to the static proteins, we get very low p-values, no matter whether we use really high quality data from low throughput experiments, or we use high throughput data, or we even use predicted data where we predict the phosphorylation sites using machine learning techniques applied to the sequences. So this shows that the dynamic proteins are much more phosphorylated than the static ones. But we remember that the dynamic proteins are different proteins in different organisms. There's also another statistical test here that I just skipped, more stringent one, showing the same. But this, of course, means that if the promoter of these genes changes a lot, so that a promoter that was periodic change into something that is not periodically regulated, then the phosphorylation side in the proteins encoded by these genes also have to evolve, because if they lose the periodic transcription regulation, they apparently also loses some level of phosphorylation. And this simply means that we have this co-evolution between regulation at different levels, at the transcriptional level and at the post-translational level. And there is a lot of case stories in this, and you can follow some of these phosphorylation sites as they disappear. So all this means that evolution works very fast. I mean, it was not expected when we did this work that the regulation of these very key genes that it changes so fast. The question is, how fast should we go from man in order to believe what we see? I mean, most drug development projects, they actually run into a showstopper when you try to transfer the animal results to man in clinical trials, and it's clear that if the regulation of these very important genes are so different in different organisms, then of course you will see much more difference between a mouse and a rat and a human being that you might expect a priori. And there's actually a lot of examples where trials in, for example, a macaque did show a particular result, and then when you moved it to a chimpanzee and of course eventually to man, then you would see a different story. So this type of work here, where we try to integrate data in order to understand how the protein complexes temporarily control the cell cycle, can also be seen as a warning against model organism. I mean, we are happy about the model organism, because then we don't have to experiment with ourselves. But we also see how few drugs that come out of that process, and the differences in the regulation may, in general, be much larger than we thought. Okay, so this was basically my story. I mean, data integration and proper probabilistic treatment of the data and the integration process was something that actually very early in bioinformatics and systems biology was hyped up as something that could be very useful. But I think it was hyped up before we had a lot of data. Now we have more and more data, so I think the data integration idea will not go away. And I think when we can transfer all this business to the level of individuals, it will even become much more interesting. So a lot of people at the center in Copenhagen was involved in this disease gene finding concept. We also had collaborators here in black. I already mentioned for the cell cycle interactome, Per Borg and Lars Juel Jensen, but also people from CBS was involved. I didn't talk about the heart development project, but we collaborate with the hospital and a lot of other hospitals actually on a lot of different corpuses of electronic patient records. Very, very interesting stuff. So thank you for your attention.
On time, so we have time for questions.
So I find the bit where I find it kind of hocus pocus quite amazing, actually, that you can pick a candidate region and then jump through the protein interaction networks and do this text mining matching, and then you correctly prioritize. I was mentally thinking about this, and I was wondering whether that was so. In protein similarity world, one would get worried about very, very close sort of orthologs and homologs in the database, giving you the ability to falsely find matches too easily in some sense. I was wondering whether there was something similar in disease space, like there were 12 different types of beta thalassemia or hemoglobin, something or other, that are all so extremely similar. I mean, they're all rated separately, as it were, as separate diseases, but they, you know, they have this, there's a kind of cluster of diseases that all fall together. So have you looked at the sort of inherent structure? I just find it quite amazing, and I'm impressed, and I'm now going to be a bit more skeptical, and I'm trying to feel for where that skepticism can come from. So is that an issue? Do you have to sort of non-redundant?
I think it is certainly not an issue, because we have worked with the entire Omium database, but we have also worked with other disease sets, but we have not any bias.
The Omium data set, what I'm saying is the Omium data set may be overrepresented in blood hemoglobin thalassemia disorders. So there's, you know, 50 such disorders, I don't know. And you keep on hitting each other. Yeah, the benchmarks, I mean, your benchmark positives, are they always seemingly the same set of diseases that are sort of actually...
No, I cannot remember. There's something in the supplementary material on this, but this is not...
I don't think it affects any of these benchmarks.
What?
Okay. I don't think it affects
no.
any of your
I mean, you have long linkage intervals with hundreds of genes,
And you're getting a hit that's coming from quite diverse diseases, in some sense.
The whole trick here seems to be that you have a lot of overlapping pathways. If you have deafness in two different diseases that seem quite different, then there is actually a molecular level overlap that produces that phenotypical overlap. So I think it boils down to the fact that maybe we only have the fact that we only have 20,000 genes.
Right.
That many genes will be related to many disorders, and then the phenotypic overlap will stem from that fact. So I mean, you know how we normally benchmark and conservatively estimate prediction performance, and we also try to do that here. It's clear that when you compare to protein structure prediction, where you have 30 years of screening out easy examples, I mean, you have technologies for screening out what is easy. Disease gene finding is not there yet in terms of what is a too easy example. It's a very valid question, but I don't think from these databases with all the diversity that we can get to 50% by having a weird bias in the data set.
So the signal that you're exploiting is that basically neighbors in the network give rise, perturbations to neighbors in the network give rise to similar phenotypes or diseases.
Makes sense.
It's consistent with everything we understand about that.
But again, one protein might have been linked to one disease because of a mutation in one individual that might not translate to another individual. It's interesting to link this together. This is why my long-term plan is to try to link this together with the stratification of the phenotypes and see where there is a systematics in many of these diseases that are known as one disease. And this is, of course, I mean, it's well known, diabetes, type 1 diabetes is not one disease. But we have to disentangle it in a way so that it can also be used to select treatments and so on. It's the same for cancer and so on. It's well known in some cases, but it will be interesting to approach it across a lot of diseases.
A more technical question about your methods for identifying periodic genes. And you said that the more modern methods were weaker, worse. Do you have any intuition or any explanation for that? What's going on?
I think what we showed in this we had one benchmark paper, but also in the bioinformatics paper, is that many of the methods are too biased in relation to either periodicity or magnitude of regulation. And our algorithm is combining both. And is sort of making an interesting compromise that then produces results that are more comparable when you analyze different data sets from the same organisms from different labs or from different type of arrest experiments. So we try in the paper to say this is more biased because it only picks out the genes that are periodic but might be very weakly regulated and so on. So we try to go into that, and I mean our algorithm is also new, and it's not that bad, and also a good algorithm from a Swedish group.
Søren, could you just define periodic specifically for those of us who? I mean, do you mean that in fact, A B follows A and C follows B and so on? Is that?
Yeah, I mean you get a high Fourier score from the analysis. It's periodic in the
Genuinely periodic in time.
Yes. I mean, you start out with the synchronized cells, and then, of course, they eventually will go out of synchronization, and then the whole thing is just average over a soup where the cells are in many different stages of the cell cycle, and then you don't get any signal anymore. But you hope that the cells will stay periodic for a couple of cell cycles. Very difficult with the plant cells, actually, for example, and so on. So you want to identify that the genes peak and follow the same sinusoidal behavior in the two cell cycles, in the two cycles, yeah.
Can you say a bit more where this benchmark data set detecting the periodic genes is coming from? How it's defined?
There are three so-called gold standard sets that we have described in the paper. So two of them are not coming from us, but I mean, you can see in the paper how we define them, and actually also the analysis questions a few of the genes in one of the sets and so on. So I mean, there are a set of 100 genes, for example, where everybody essentially agrees that these are periodic and so on. But can you see that in the transcriptomics data? That's the question. And of course, we know that transcriptomics data is very noisy. It is very bad. It's notoriously bad for weakly expressed proteins. And we have another paper on how to identify periodicity in weakly expressed proteins and so on. So it's a difficult a task, but you can see I cannot remember the three benchmark sets that we use, but they are described in the bioinformatics paper, I think in the first column actually.
Have you gone back and looked at some of the new chemistat data that from McKnight group and some of the others, where the cells don't lose synchrony over time, and so they maintain very nice periodicity over multiple cell cycles?
Yeah, not in this analysis. This is from the data sets.
Critically expressed sets.
For sure.
Are there other questions? Not, let's thank CERN again. We have a break.